Welcome. You're listening to Michael Luoma, undergraduate fellow at the Center for Ethics at the University of Toronto. Today, as part of our Conversations About Ethics podcast series, I am with the philosopher Christine Korsgaard. Professor Korsgaard is the Arthur Kingsley Porter Professor of Philosophy at Harvard University and the author of numerous books and articles on moral, political, and legal philosophy. She will be presenting a lecture later today entitled Animal Selves and the Good. Thanks again for being with us here today, Professor.
Thank you.
So you've done a lot of work on Kantian philosophy of mind and Kantian moral and political philosophy. In your earlier works, The Sources of Normativity and Self-Constitution, you've probed the cognitive faculties which make normativity possible, which enable our moral agency, as it were. What role do you see this sort of inquiry as playing in your current work on our moral obligations to animals?
This material is absolutely central to the current work that I'm doing. In several senses. First of all, I use the Kantian framework I developed earlier to explain the differences between human beings and the other animals, or to partly explain those differences that I think are relevant to our moral situation with regard to the other animals. I also use the Kantian framework to explain both why I think we have duties to the other animals. My argument for that is based on Kant's argument for the formula of humanity, use Kant's theory of natural rights to explain the sense in which I think animals ought to have rights. So the work is still very much within the Kantian framework in that sense. In the work I'm doing on the good, which is related to the project on animals, it's more Aristotle I use to fill out the picture, but that's more metaphysics than philosophy of mind and ethics.
Could you briefly explain what you mean when you talk about something as having a good?
When I talk about something as having a good, what I mean is that there are things that the creature pursues and wants for their own sake and enjoys when she gets them and that are welcome from her point of view. So they're good for her in that sense, particularly things about which it would make sense to say that they make her life good.
Can you give some examples of what would make an animal life go well or the sorts of things an animal would want for its own sake?
Well, let me fill this out a little bit. You'll be hearing more about this afternoon. But when you think of an organism as having a function, which we can do, which Aristotle first taught us to do, you think of the organism as being organized so as to survive and reproduce. Now, I take it that in a way what brought the good in the final sense into the world is the fact that animals, because they are agents and represent things to themselves, pursue some of their functional goods as ends, thus transforming them into final goods. So the good for an animal would turn out simply to be having a life of the kind characteristic of that animal, surviving and reproducing and interacting with the world and with others in the way that that animal characteristically does.
So what is it to be an end in itself for Kant, and what is the continuing attractiveness of this ideal, and especially in this context when we're considering our obligations to animals?
To be an end in itself is to be entitled to a certain form of recognition and respect on the basis of your capacities. It's to be someone whose interests and choices and goods are to be taken into account for their own sake. And it's certainly to be someone who is not to be treated either as an instrument to another creature's good or merely sacrificed for the sake of another creature's good. I take it that there are, in other words, I've argued there are actually two senses of end in itself. One of which you find explicitly in Kant's argument, the other I claim is implicit in Kant's argument, and the two senses are you're an end in itself if you're an autonomous being and you demand respect for your choices from other autonomous beings, and you're an end in itself if you have a good of your own and you demand others respect that good in a certain way. So people and animals are both ends in themselves, although people are ends in themselves in an additional way. I take part of the attractiveness of the ideal. I mean, I suppose the ideal sounds attractive in its own right, but I take part of the attractiveness of the ideal to emerge when you realize that when we interact with each other, if we're not simply going to be objects to one another, sort of manipulating each other to get what we want, then what we have to be doing is interacting as two ends in itself to each other, taking each other's needs right. and interests seriously. And so there's a way in which it's insofar as we're ends in itself that we are persons to each other, that we are fellow creatures to each other, that we're not alone in the world. We're not just, you know, somebody manipulating everything from on high in order to get what he or she wants.
So we can move directly from a conception of an animal as an end in themselves to an animal as a rights bearer? Or is there an intermediary step? If we take an end in itself to be the sort of thing that can't be manipulated simply according to our whims?
I do think there's some more steps you have to take before you get to the conception of an animal as a bearer of rights. And I think animals are in fact bearers of rights in a rather distinctive sense, not the same sense. A lot of the rights that we hold against each other that we think of when we think of our legal rights or our civil rights or the Bill of Rights are rights we hold against each other as autonomous beings, each of whom has choices that need to be respected. To attach rights to the idea of someone's having a good takes a little bit more work, but I think it can be done. The sense in which I think animals have rights is that animals have rights against humanity, collectively speaking. I don't think they have rights that are in the first instance rights against people as individuals, although it comes down to that. And I certainly don't think they have rights as against each other. I think one reason why people balk at the idea of animal rights is they're balking at the idea that, you know, prey would have rights against predators or something like that. But I do think that animals have rights against human beings, collectively speaking, because of the way in which we have essentially taken control of a world that once belonged to all of us and made them submit to our ways of reshaping that world in ways about which they've had no choice and that are bad for them. So I think you need that kind of a story in order to get the idea of animal rights. I should say also Kant, in his story about human rights, uses the premise, familiar from social contract theories in general, that the world was once commonly possessed by all the people in it. And if you just move to the premise that the world was once commonly possessed by all the creatures in it, then you start to get a story about animal rights.
Would you say that our moral evaluation of our relationship to animals rests partially upon an analogy between the value of human to animal cognition? And if so, what role do you see neuroscience as playing on the debate over animal rights, if any?
Okay, I wouldn't say our moral evaluation rests on an analogy between human and animal cognition, because I take our moral relationship to animals to rest on the fact that we ourselves, insofar as we are animals, have a good. So it's not an analogy, it's a sameness. We have a good for which we demand consideration, and we should give consideration to what's good for them as well, since there really is no reason, no ground of our demanding consideration for it, except that it's what's good for us. So that's a sameness, not an analogy. as far as neuroscience is concerned, I would think the sciences in general might help us to work some out some of the details of what we owe to animals by teaching us more about what the capacities of animals are and what their experiences might be like. The kinds of duties that I think we have to animals that have to do with their having a good requires that animals have at least the kind of cognitive faculties that enable them to feel pleasure and pain. And it also requires, again, I'll be talking about this afternoon, that we may have more extensive duties to animals who have more of a consistent point of view that extends over time, more of a so-called personal identity. And that fact, how much of a point of view an animal maintains over time, has to do with whether the animal is capable of certain kinds of memory, whether the animal is capable of learning, whether the animal forms social bonds of a certain kind. All of those are things that tend to unify the point of view of an animal over time. And the reason I think that matters is because I think the more unified an animal is over time, the more it makes sense to think of the animal's good as something temporally extended. So just to work out the details of what counts as mistreating an animal or not, we need to know a great deal more about their capacities.
Right. So onto this question about our precise duties to animals, which you have said are in virtue of the specific capacities of animals that we share with those animals. Canadian political philosopher Will Kimlicka has suggested that we extend citizenship to other animals, and perhaps that's one of those cases that you alluded to, where people are somewhat reticent to acknowledge animal rights. It seems somewhat inappropriate to extend a notion like citizenship to animals. So what do you think? Do you think it would be appropriate to go about ensuring our responsibilities to animals are met through something like a loose sense of citizenship?
Well, I suppose it depends on how loose you think it is. I do think that animals have rights, and I think that those are, by their nature, coercibly enforceable rights. They're natural rights. They're legal rights by their nature. And insofar as I think every country should be acknowledging those rights and writing them into their laws, that gives animal a position of something like citizenship. But I also think that it's a permanent part of our relation to animals. Permanent, I mean, in the sense of we can't get rid of it now, that at least for the animals about whom we are most concerned, we make the rules of the world that we live in together. And they are, to that extent, inevitably a subject population, not full citizens. And I don't see any advantage to not acknowledging that. We can still try to realize their interests as well as possible, but I think it just has to be acknowledged that it's us doing that for them, not them having a voice themselves. The other part of this, I guess, is that citizenship, in a way, I've suggested maybe it's a little too much, but there's a way in which it's not enough, because protecting the interests of animals involves international questions. Animals that are poached in one country because somebody in another country thinks their horns have aphrodisiac properties or something like that. It looks as if what we need is a set of international and not just national agreements on what counts as the acceptable treatment of animals.
A follow-up question on that. You were a student of John Rawls and influenced by his seminal works, among others, The Theory of Justice. So given that animals are beings with interests, and Rawls seeks to neutrally take into account the interests of everyone through his famous thought device of the Veil of Ignorance, do you think that perhaps we should think of animals as being behind the Veil of Ignorance? Or would that not be a useful way about thinking about how we could precisely generate our obligations to animals?
I don't think of animals themselves as being behind the Veil of Ignorance, but I do think that when we are behind the Veil of Ignorance, we should be thinking of ourselves as representatives of their interests as well as our own.
Well, thank you for being here with us today, Professor Korsgaard. I look forward to hearing your lecture later on.
Thank you very much.